Well, what can we say? First of all, the important things, and that's a huge welcome to UK Column viewers. Thank you for joining Debbie Evans and myself, Brian Gerrish, in the 2024 edition, the first edition of No Smoke Without Fire. And so it's great to be back. Debbie, welcome into the studio.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. It's lovely to be back. And are we going to be lighting a fuse today, I wonder?
Well, from that wonderful little introductory video clip of the match igniting, which is our new opening sequence for No Smoke Without Fire, I think we are going to be lighting a fire under a few things. So I can imagine that the opening video that we've just played at the coronation is going to ruffle some feathers. There are some people I know who are still in the frame of mind that this was wonderful to see and the UK had got a new king. Not only crowned, but also anointed, which we'll be coming on to. But of course, many other people look at that ceremony, as do I, wondering what on earth I'm really looking at. So for this edition of No Smoke Without Fire, and we think it might take a number of episodes to deal with it, Debbie and I thought we would discuss King Charles and the coronation. So Debbie, I'm going to pass it over to you. What does that do for your memories?
Oh, do you know what? Before I saw what I'm seeing now, I loved that piece of music, Zadok the Priest. And it was always a piece of music that I held close to my heart for many reasons. And now, having looked at the origins, having looked at what I'm seeing now, it fills me with chills because I'm not actually sure of what I'm looking at. But what I'm looking at, I believe, is hidden behind all of the ceremonial and the costumes. I mean, all the world's a stage. My goodness, even the Princess Royal before the coronation was talking about the coronation. And she said, well, we are the actors, aren't we? We've got to get it right. We're nervous. We're obviously nervous that we're not going to get it right because we're being seen by the world. But what is the world seeing?
And you saw ritual, that, Debbie. What the world is seeing is ritual. And it's
triumphant,
ritual.
Ritual. It's so triumphant. God save them. Do you remember just before the coronation, unusually, it's never happened before, I believe, in that we were all asked to pledge allegiance to the king at the coronation, and it kicked off a bit of a media storm because people were saying no, you know, they weren't willing to pledge allegiance to the king. But clearly that was, I mean, if you look at the words of the anthem there, may the king live forever, God save the king, rejoice, hallelujah. This is a celebration of the anointing and the crowning of the king. So for me, the coronation has some dark meaning behind it, which I know we're going to explore.
We are. Well, I'm just going to kick off with a little report in the Jewish Chronicle, which I wasn't aware of at the time of the coronation. But when I read this article, and I encourage other people to read it, the title is Why I'm Sure That Charles Will Be, quote, a king for the Jews. And this is written by the prince's biographer, Catherine Mayer. And she's reporting on, quote, how our next monarch could transform Jewry. So I found this very, very interesting article. And there's a little bit of text that I'll read here. It's hardly surprising, given that the Prince of Wales' relationship with the community famously began at birth. She's talking the Jewish community. He was circumcised by leading Merle, Rabbi Jacob Snowman, instead of the royal physician. He enthusiastically recounted his close friendship with Lord Sacks, who he met on a plane to Rabin's funeral, at a dinner honouring the former chief rabbi. He was the first royal to attend a chief rabbi's inauguration ceremony, that of Ephraim Mirvis, at which he wore a blue velvet kippa with the Prince of Wales feathers badge. And speaking at a Holocaust Memorial Day event last week, he described the show as a warning to all of us. I was simply completely unaware of these deep links through to the Jewish community. And I certainly didn't understand that the Jewish community were looking at the crowning of Prince Charles as if, maybe I'm taking it too far because she chooses her words very carefully, but almost as though he's going to be a new king of the Jews for the Jews. And this was nothing that seemed to appear in Western press, although it was an open report here in the Jewish Chronicle. What do you make of this, Debbie?
Well, you know, when I first started deep diving into this whole subject, I was as surprised as you, to be honest, Brian. I mean, and then I found it actually on the Royal Family, and we'll come to that on the Royal Family website, and we'll come to that maybe later. But it appears that all male heirs in the Royal Family are circumcised. And there was a bit of controversy surrounding the Princess of Wales, Diana, when Prince William was born, because I don't think that she was wanting this to happen for Prince William. So there was controversy around that. And I think Prince Harry's written about it in his book, Spare. But let's not forget, too, with that article, Prince Charles is different from the Prince of Wales, for example, that we have now, in that when Prince Charles was one of the only Prince of Wales's invested. So in 1969, he was invested by the Queen. And this was an open air ceremony at Carnarvon Castle, surrounded by the Welsh flag with the red dragon. There's a lot we could say about the investiture, but that makes Prince Charles, the then Prince Charles, almost higher, if you like, as this very special prince. So when I read that article in the Jewish Chronicle, I wasn't altogether surprised, because he has got a very deep and meaningful relationship with the Jewish community. In fact, I think he's just actually knighted the chief rabbi. So there is a very close Jewish connection. Although when he was Prince of Wales, I don't believe he actually ever visited Israel, but he has visited Israel in the last 3 or 4 years, just at the end of his princeship, if you like, before he was before he became king. And he went to the Holy Land as well, and he's planning on another visit to Israel. So there is a very close relationship with Israel and also with the Middle East, as we'll come on to see.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, that's an excellent lead into the second paragraph from the Jewish Chronicle article that I've chosen here. He's deeply devout. Religion is incredibly important to him. Part of his philosophy is that there's a kinship amongst religion, that they're different expressions of the same truth, the same God, which is why he doesn't feel that they're at odds with each other. Interfaith and faith are hugely important to him. It's been mistaken for a New Age light form of religion. This adds to the fog of misunderstanding around him, the concerns that he's not a serious member of the Church of England, which of course he is. Now, when I read this paragraph, to me, I automatically read it as a defensive paragraph, but I certainly agree with the lady who's writing there, Catherine Myers, that there is a fog of misunderstanding around him, because his adherence to the Church of England doesn't seem to me to be an adherence to the Christian faith. And this is a man who, in embracing all religions, seems to be embracing all religions in a way that the drive for a one world religion, this is the same path, I think. And I've mentioned this many times over the years, but there's a really excellent book by a man called Lee Penn. And he writes in a very thick book about the work towards creating a one-world religion. And to me, it seems that Charles, at least, you can't call him a Christian. He's something different. But I think this little defensive paragraph picked up on the fact that there are people questioning what actually his beliefs are. But I'll add to that, and you picked up on this, that he was anointed with holy oil, which had actually come from Jerusalem. I've taken the CNN report here, but there are other reports. But here's the little headline: holy oil to anoint King Charles III on his coronation has been consecrated in Jerusalem. Now, it was consecrated by two people from the Orthodox Church based in Jerusalem. But nevertheless, we get more of the ritual, and the formula of the oil has been changed, because previously, apparently, it contained something from the stomach lining of a sperm whale. That's now been removed, so that this was it was an acceptable oil to, I would say, vegetarians, but maybe my analysis is not correct because it's all very foggy. So I'll throw that one back to you. And then I think you've got a little bit here on his plans to beef up the Balmoral estate.
Yeah, well, a number of points there. I mean, I'm sorry if this is going to offend anybody watching. I mean, my own mother goes to church every single week and gives her collection and presumes that her collection is going to good causes. But you know what, Brian? There's money. There's money in faith. And there's a lot of money in faith, a lot of money in religion. And when you put them all together, that's a big pot of money. So why would you just want to be on one side of the fence without actually sort of moving around in all circles? And this is what we're going to see. We're going to see that Prince Charles is very much a multi-faith monarch. King Charles. I mean, for the first time ever, I mean, I could go on for hours about the symbology during the coronation. I mean, there was just so much of it, including the Grim Reaper, for anybody that's watching and thinking, oh, I wonder if Debbie's going to mention that. There's so much symbology in the coronation, but faith is money. And I'm afraid, as we're going to find out, faith to King Charles is nature, the environment. And when you get people worshipping the planet and worshipping nature through religion, then you start to see things that maybe they were trying to keep hidden. And that's what we're going to be exploring, I think. But this one world religion, is it the environment? And of course, at the coronation, he had all members of faiths. He had five of the major faiths present, which we never had in previous coronations. So you had the leaders of the Roman Catholic Church, the leaders of the Sikh, Hindu, Islam, I think. There was invitations to everyone from all faiths. So defender of Church of England, no, he said he's defender of faith. So that includes everybody. And like I say, there's a lot of money to be made through faith.
Yeah. So if I just throw this one at you, do you trust King Charles?
No. And I've met him. You know, I live in Cornwall, which is a duchy. So when, I mean, Prince Charles, as he was then, was a prince for many years, the longest heir in waiting. And as such, he relied on the Duchy of Cornwall for the public purse. He relied on the money that came from Cornwall to pay for all of his private engagements and all of his public engagements. And yet Cornwall is one of the poorest, well, it's the second poorest area past Lithuania in Europe. Does Cornwall get anything back? Does he do anything for Cornwall? Does he do anything for anybody? I've met him. Do I trust him? No.
No. Well, I got to say, I feel the same. I certainly don't trust him. I certainly don't think that he's got the best interests of the United Kingdom in his mind. His mind is absolutely with the global agenda. I don't trust his position on religion, because I think that he's moving us towards something which actually is offensive. Ultimately, it's offensive to all the major world religions, because it's all about the control of mankind. But I do not see how King Charles can be a Christian. And personally, I don't believe he is a Christian. Now, I can imagine a few hackles going up, maybe in the audience, but that's my position. And if somebody can convince me otherwise, I'm very happy to listen to it. But the ritual, what was actually happening in that big pantomime, I'd really like to understand more. And I think the research that you've done is going to take us deeper, at least, into what this man is. And maybe that will help us get around the fog that his biographer said existed around him. So what is the good man going to do to the estate in Balmoral?
Well, we're going to use public funds, of course, your money, and we're going to restore it in a carbon plan with the help of £650,000, actually. So this is apparently going to generate money for the Cairngorms community. It's the green finance model. So the green king strikes again. But, you know, we look at this sort of model. He uses models everywhere. You know, he has model villages, model towns. We've got one here in Cornwall. There's Poundbury as well. He creates models for people then to say, OK, well, we'll pay into this. So we'll have that model rolled out everywhere. And this is just another model at our cost.
Yeah. And you've mentioned the poverty in Cornwall, which is absolutely true. Of course, you know, the duchy estate he's moved on from now as king, if I understand that correctly. But in his day as Prince Charles, of course, thousands and thousands of hectares of land in the duchy, and what was actually coming back for the people of Cornwall. By sheer coincidence, as I drove into the up to the column, the UK column this morning, there was a duchy timber lorry delivering to one of the builders' merchants a little bit down the road. And it was the first time I'd seen a duchy timber lorry, but I thought, yeah, that'll be some of the trees harvested off the land and sold for profit for the duchy. None of it is going to be coming back to the people. So is this a caring king? I don't think so. But no. Apparently he's good at writing letters.
Well, you know, this has just been released, actually, the news that his letter of thanks to Jimmy Savile is going up for auction. His Majesty shows appreciation for a gift and seeks guidance over hospital donation in handwritten correspondence with the disgraced DJ. I mean, you know, talk about in your face. And we know all about his spider letters. He was very good when he was Prince of Wales at writing letters. And I think the question goes is, who would want to ever buy that letter? Who would even want to bid for it, to be honest, really?
No, it should go on the fire. In fact, the match at the beginning of this programme would deal with it very well.
Yes, it would. Yeah. 100%. I can't think of anybody. I mean, it sends me chills. You know, who would want that? Who would want it?
Yeah. It's dark, isn't it? The mere fact that this transaction should happen is very dark. But if we delve in to get a bit of an understanding of King Charles, we've got to go back and look at family connections and family members, haven't we?
Yeah, let's go back to the beginning, and the apple never falls far from the tree, does it? So let's take a memory back to, I think this is 1970, to Prince, as he was then, Prince Charles's father, the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip. I think we might have a little bit of video to remind people of a conference that Prince Philip was giving, where he took his son, the then Prince Charles, for the very first time to listen to what he was saying.
Thank you. totally useless for a lot of well-meaning people to wring their hands in conference and to point out the dangers of pollution or destruction of the countryside if no one is willing or capable of taking any action.
Well, there we are. That's pretty telling, isn't it? So what do we have? We have a child who was groomed into this way of thinking.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly that same word, actually, Brian. I'd written it down because as we're talking, and I mean, the beauty about No Smokes is that we chat and things come up in conversation. And as we were watching that, I wrote down the word groomed. Because clearly that's where the grooming really started with a vengeance. And, you know, you look back at the Duke of Edinburgh and people are going to remember what we're going to be saying next, which was something that Prince Philip said about reincarnating as a deadly virus to solve overpopulation. So, you know, this agenda was in your face. And if his father had that kind of opinion and that kind of attitude, then you can see who he was groomed by. But, I mean, there's nothing like seeing is believing, is there? So let's remind ourselves of the late Duke of Edinburgh and what he actually did say.
What do you see as the biggest challenges in conservation?
The growing human population. Because if where we are, there's nothing else.
And do you have views about what should be done about that?
Can't you guess?
Well, it could be on a spectrum from mass sterilisation to greater availability of contraception. I don't know. I don't know what your views are as to what can be done about it.
Well, I think it might be described as a voluntary family limitation.
I just say wow. When you look at that clip and you're looking at the man and you're looking at how he's delivering, he doesn't want to say what's really in his head. But from where we are, that's where his opening statement, from where we are. Well, exactly. But the we is the special class. We are looking at these horrible peasants, and we need to do something.
Brian, I have to say that goes back to the WEF. You know, you will own nothing. You, not we. This is all about their little club class and making the planet beautiful for them and doing stuff and not having millions of people running around creating waste and pollution. This is all about them, their elite club.
Yeah. So when we, as the mere hoi polloi, try and get our minds inside their minds, it's very difficult because these people clearly regard themselves as very special, and they don't seem to have any acknowledgement that they are, what's the word? You know, they've got a huge golden spoon in their mouths, and they have a life of immense wealth on the back of the rest of the population. The more I see it, the more incredible I think this system is. But to me, do these members of the royal family at least have the best interests of mankind? Is that what they're really doing? The best interests of mankind in mind? No, I don't.
You said special. They're certainly special.
Yeah.
But for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, but they're going to save the world.
Oh. Yeah, yes. And, you know, going back to the Duke of Edinburgh, you know, let's see where this actually did start, because it did, you know, from the research, I've only gone back as far as the Duke of Edinburgh, but it's quite significant. And this all started with the World Wildlife Fund. Remember the panda on the front, and he was very, very pro environment and wildlife preservation and conservation. And this, as you're going to see, really leads on to the agenda that we see today, because he was a patron of the WWF and he served as an advocate. He was a champion for the environment. And then one thing led to another. So the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund, led to the Duke of Edinburgh's conservation scheme. And when you go further into it and you see what he did for the Duke of Edinburgh's young people, that was all about Outward Bound and nature and conservation and rewarding young people. But I think there was a much more sinister agenda.
I think with how we see these people operate, a lot of it is sort of smoke and mirrors. So to say that everything that they have done is bad, I don't agree with that at all. And I know from personal experiences of family where my own children dealt with the Duke of Edinburgh wards, and they got out doing some pretty lengthy walks, some quite tough walking, and certainly they benefited from it and other youngsters at their schools. And of course, it's a national event that a lot of young people get an awful lot out of it. So I just wanted to say that, because I don't believe it's the case that everything that they've done has been part of the agenda to go where we're going to show they're going. But did they do the good things out of true, what's the word? I've forgotten the word. Do they do it out of, you know, true love for their nation and the wider public of UK? Or did they do it in order to balance out the other things? This is where it's tricky.
Well, I mean, I take your point, but I mean, I just go back to there was a lot of money involved in the Duke of Edinburgh's scheme. It was a huge multi-million pound operation. And yes, I agree, you know, many, many youngsters got huge benefits from it and used the Duke of Edinburgh's award to move further on with their careers, which is all good. It's all good. But there was a darker side, and there's a darker side that lurks underneath. And I think that's what I can see now, in that charities, when does a charity become a charity? When does it become a quango? Where is that fine line between charitable giving and the good coming from it? And then a lot of people making a lot of money. And it you know, a lot of money has been made on the back of all of these big charities, whereas little grassroots charities, you know, that do just as good work, get no recognition, no funding, because they get drowned out by the bigger charities with royal patronage. But I think the question is what are the royal patrons getting out of this? Because we see as the public them doing good deeds and, oh, yes, they're patron for this and that's great for the charity. But what are they getting out of it? And I think that's the other side that I'm starting to see now.
Yeah. Okay, so I distracted you a bit there. Sorry about that. So you were heading down the route to what they've been getting up to, and St George's House is an important place. Why did you pick up on this?
The thing is, the Duke of Edinburgh made this connection, the connection that we're seeing now in 2024, this science and religion. This all came about with him in 1965, and then he went into cahoots with the Dean of Windsor, the Right Reverend Robin Woods, and founded St. George's House in Windsor. And that's, I mean, it's still existing today, and it's for the laity and members of faith to go and chill out and talk and discuss. But actually, when you look at St. George's House today, you can see that, yes, it is obviously used for clergy as well, but it's governed by the Representative Knights of the Most Noble Order of the Garter, headed by the Princess Royal and His Grace the Duke of Abercorn. So, you know, and of course, when you think of the Knights, you think, oh, Lord Blair, you know, and it starts to get, well, who is actually meeting at St. George's House? When you look at the other members of St. George's House, there's some some very very big names there, baronesses and Dame Caroline Spelman, you can see there, Lord William Waldegrave. You know, this is for the elite. This is basically a club to discuss for the elite. And I just started to delve further into the royal family website, and you could see this fusion, because Mike Robinson always uses the word fusion, this fusion between environment and science and faith and religion. So when you jump on from this, and you can get all of this information on the Royal Family website. I mean, this is where I've been, the Royal Family website. And here you can see that if you jump on in 1986 to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Worldwide Fund for Nature, there was going to be this conference where it was the Duke of Edinburgh's idea to go to Assisi and host a meeting with five main religious communities to discuss about the environment and what they were going to do for the future of the earth, etc. And as a result of that meeting, an organisation was formed, and it was called ARC. Don't we hear a lot of ARC education and ARC organisations? But this was the Alliance of Religions and Conservations. And although this is closed now, and we'll look, and I promise we'll come on to what it's been replaced with, because it has been replaced. But this was the first organisation really to link all the faiths together. And it was supported by a load of organisations, including the World Bank, including WWF International. I mean, you can see the list there. They were, you know, very, very well supported. But that's the way that this all began. But the organisation of ARC was always under the control, if you like, of the Duke of Edinburgh, Prince Philip. And they had a whole trustee board. You can see some very prestigious names there. And ARC carried on until fairly recently. It closed, actually, after 23 years, because they decided that, actually, we need to do more. We need to expand more. And what's interesting about that slide there, that you can see Prince Philip, what he says on creation: if you believe in God, then you should feel a responsibility to care for his creation. But like I say, ARC closed, and they decided to replace it with this huge organisation in this very glossy website called Faith Invest, which basically brings all the faith groups together to talk about what they're going to invest. I mean, I don't know if you want to butt in there, Brian, because we're going quite fast, and we can see the growth of this science, environment, religion agenda. And the formation of ARC was where it all started. I don't know if you want to jump in and add anything.
Well, all I wanted to really say is how fascinating I found this when you started the trail on this, or when we got into it and we started to discuss it together. It was utterly fascinating, because it just takes you in deeper and deeper and deeper. Who are these people? Where does their power come from? What are they trying to do? So, you know, all the language, or often the language, is very soft. You know, we're trying to protect God's creation. But what are they actually talking about? They're not talking about loving your God and loving one another, which would be the Christian message. This is almost coming down to Mother Earth approach. And then you say, so are they part of the Christian Foundation in UK, or are they something different? And then the other bit on your list that you just showed on screen, of course, is the World Bank is there. Now, in most of these projects, if you don't see it at the first layer, the moment you delve into it a bit and go into the second layer, you're absolutely going to be seeing all of the world banking system, or elements of the world banking system, supporting these projects. And then I say to myself very cynically, and of course we know how the banks have people's well-being at the forefront of their business activity. I mean, to me, it's madness to suggest that the Bank of England is looking out to protect the people in UK or preserve the planet. It's a complete nonsense, because their whole business is about destruction of people, families, businesses. Even with Mark Carney, who, again, Mike Robinson pointed out several times on UK Column News, Mark Carney, when he was their boss of the Bank of England, saying that if businesses didn't adopt our, he was talking about the bank's green initiatives, they would be punished. They would be put out of business. So that's the sort of mindset of the big money, billions of pounds, that's coming in behind the sorts of projects you're talking about. This is a poisonous mix.
Yeah, well, it's money. Again, you see, I rub my fingers there. It all comes down to money at the end of the day. And let's not forget, we are God's creation, right? So, of course we should be protected, but we're not being protected. These organisations aren't protecting us. We're just nobody. So when you mentioned banks. So let's have a look at the bank, because on ARC's website, because there is still an archived ARC website, and you can see there that if you look down the bottom, immediately governments, which is a situation we have now, governments acting with NGOs, again, NGOs mentioned there, the public, and faiths. And then who are the partners? The World Bank, Mott Foundation, the Norwegian government, Valley Foundation, WWF, USAID, UNICEF, and others. And as we're going to come on in a minute to see, we're going to find Citibank involved in it as well. So when you go to look at the origins, they've got a nice little calendar of the kind of how ARC was moving forward and how it became Faith Invest. And there you can see in 2001, ARC in partnership with Citigroup. So immediately the banks are involved. And then in 2007, they were asked to publish the Atlas of Religions. And then the UN, the United Nations, got involved. And then, boom, you get the mention of sustainable development goals.
Just add in there that the Atlas of Religions, which includes the first attempt to chart the faith's investments worldwide. So they weren't interested in the faiths and the messages of those faiths. They were interested in where their investments were. And my brain says you want to know where their investments are, because if you know where their investments are, you can control those faiths via their investments.
If you go back to that slide, Brian, if you go back to that previous slide of the origins, you'll see halfway down there, Faith in Finance in 2016. So this is very much a financial arrangement. So then ARC decided that they would have this this conference in Zug, and they would discuss, you know, this finance thing is it's a big deal. There's a lot of money involved. So how can we move forward? Because obviously ARC couldn't move forward, and that's where Faith Invest came into being. And this is a whole movement to invest billions. I mean, we're talking billions of dollars. And I know you've got a lot to say about, you know, what the Church of England has got in its bank.
I smile, Debbie, when I see this, because it says, for example, the Church of England's investment fund alone manages funds in excess of $9 billion. But the UK column a couple of years ago now was lifting the lid on the fact that the Church of England, Welby himself, was working with global investors on a green fund, green environmental fund, an initiative in which they were talking about trillions of dollars. And it was trillions of pounds that the Church of England was involved with in relation to that initiative. And we made a very big thing about the fact that at the moment, if you talk to people in local parishes, the big thing that they're all talking about is the buildings are all falling down and the roofs of the churches are leaking. But when they go to the main, the main heart, the head of the Church of England, the Anglican Church, they're told there's no money and they've got to raise it in the parishes. But actually, behind the scenes, these hypocrites in the Anglican Church are dealing in billions of pounds and trillions of pounds, even with Welby being photographed hobnobbing with the world's international bankers, including Christine Lagarde. I can still see the photo in my head because they've all got their glass of champagne. This is where Archbishop Welby is. And of course, he is the man running, who was running the crowning ceremony for Charles III. So to me, anybody that suggests this is to do with Christianity is simply unaware of what the real Christian message is.
I mean, he's a banker. He was a banker, Welby. And, you know, interestingly, we haven't got a slide, but maybe in our No Smoke 2, because we're never going to get through all of the evidence that I've found in one hit. But we, down in Truro Cathedral recently, there was an art installation of Earth. So we were all having to, well, I wasn't, but people were being asked to go and worship Earth. You know, you can see where this is coming, the whole environment agenda. But let's go back to Faith Invest and see who's behind Faith Invest and who's actually on the board. So the chief executive is Lorna Gold. Now, if you look at her, you can see that she's overseen the development agency of the Catholic Church at senior level in Tracare. And she's also the chair of the, I can never say this properly, Brian,
Laudato,
so you may have to correct
Laudato
me.
Laudato Si' Movement.
Yeah.
I'll read it for you. She was a member of the Vatican's COVID Commission Economics Task Force that's based in Ireland. So that's an interesting little mix.
Isn't it just? And then you've got Martin Palmer, who, of course, was involved with ARC. So they're bringing ARC into Faith Invest. But he was also working with Prince Philip. And he's part of the BBC. He was been a contributor to the BBC. He's been a lay preacher for the Church of England. You know, when you look at the people that are actually involved, I'm sorry, I clipped off his name. I do apologise, but you have a gentleman there working for Rockefeller Capital Management, Citigroup again, the bank. You've got Catherine Arnold, who was British ambassador to Mongolia. So you've got a whole selection of people running this organisation, Ireland Stop Climate Chaos, Irish Jesuits and Eco-Jesuits. Now, we're going to come on to the eco movement in a minute, but Lumina, all sorts of people involved, including Obama administration and this events manager, Pippa Arnold. I mean, she's been involved in multi-faith environment groups and she's been working with the United Nations. The Norwegian government figures very highly in this and does in quite a few quite a few of the rabbit holes I've been down. And also, of course, their Buckingham Palace. So we've got this huge organisation which are literally bringing in millions. And let's face it, Prince Charles, King Charles wants trillions of pounds for his sustainable goals. So we've got these people running this organisation, but who are they partnered with? And when you see who they're partnered with and who they're trading with, you know, I mean, I'll let you read some of the names there, Brian, because it's just like gobsmacking, to be honest.
Well, we've got the UN Environment, we've got the World Wildlife Fund International, the Vatican's COVID Commission, the Vatican's Dicastery for Promoting Integral Human Development. My goodness, I don't know what that is, but it doesn't sound nice. We've got the World's Evangelical Alliance, the World Bank's Climate Investment Funds, China Taoist Association, Religions for Peace, the Interfaith Centre for Corporate Responsibility, the UN Multi-Faith Task Force, the United Religions Initiative. Now, that one immediately sticks out to me because Lee Penn mentions that many times in his book on the One World Religion. Interfaith Power and Light, Green Faith, Eco-Seek, and many more. I look at the titles and, you know, pick a few. Who at the moment is actually working in the world to put an end to the violence in Ukraine or the slaughter in Gaza? Is Britain, is UK standing up for that? No. US, no, we're pumping in the munitions, and yet we're to believe that when we see our governments involved in these sorts of initiatives with the royalty, that it's all got the best interests of mankind at heart. I mean, I don't see it.
I mean, all of this, Brian, is simply, well, it's remarkable. The next few slides have got a lot of information on them, so I think it's probably best that we just mention a couple of points and ask people to freeze the screen and read in detail some of the things that you're going to see in the next few slides, because they are quite crowded. But just to give it a little bit of context there, so it says that Faith Group have billions of dollars invested on the global stock markets. Gives you an idea of amounts. So we're looking at the Church of England Church Commissioners, 9.2 billion, Church Pension, 3 billion, United Methodist Church in the US, 28 billion, Vatican Bank, 5 billion euros of managed assets. And it says that the major faiths have had a long tradition of what they will not invest in based upon core values, Islam and Taoism. But of course, all of this environment agenda is something that everybody's very happy to buy into. So, I mean, we'll just flip through these next few slides, and you might want to just highlight a few points as well. I haven't highlighted any particularly because they're all just as important. But really, well, this is just to tie in the sustainable goals.
Yeah, that one just jumped off the screen at me. It's the second one down. What a wonderful statement this is. The values espoused by most faith groups are aligned with the aims of most of the sustainable development goals. This is a twisting of what truth is that's beyond belief. So what faith is about is actually, by some coincidence, it's the same as the sustainable development goals. And they put here, e.g., end poverty and hunger, care for the sick, protect the earth. But of course, if we look into the sustainable development goals, the one things they don't care about are mankind. It's obvious.
Choose another one.
So it says, engaging faith leaders and faith fund managers on faith-consistent investing, and that will increase the proportion of funds allocated to values-based investments. I'll read that again because it's so interesting. Engaging faith leaders and faith fund managers on faith-consistent investing will increase the proportion of funds allocated to values-based investments. So you're going to take money which is held by the faiths, and you're going to ship it across to what they call values-based investments. And the values-based investments that I see around me all the time are to do with everything like climate change, net zero, Agenda 2030, sustainable development goals. Those, they constantly use the mask that they're values-based.
Mm. Well, I tell you what, let's look at the evidence. This is a lucky dip. So let's look at the evidence, Brian, and you pop your hand in the lucky dip and you pull out some of those points because they're all extremely important.
Within the financial world, the potential of the faiths has long been understood by organisations such as the Interfaith Centre on Corporate Responsibility, ICCR in New York, which pioneered social stakeholder engagements by the faiths. So this is drawing the faiths into the control mechanism, social stakeholders. In February 2020, the Church of England's Pension Board launched the FTSE TPI Climate Transition Index, which tracks whether companies align to 2DC or below 2DC net zero, transferring a mere 600 million of its assets. So we can't fix the roofs, we can't feed the poor in the parishes, but we've got 600 million to go on to a FTSE transition index. It's brilliant. It's brilliant, Debbie.
Oh, yeah, no, it really is. And okay, so let's go on and look at the enablers, Brian. How many faith traditions have we got involved in this? It's a big operation.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Faith Invest and its meeting in Zug, Switzerland in 2017. They go on to say strong relationships with faith groups, extensive knowledge, capital about faiths, and the long history of engaging faiths via our parent organisation, Alliance of Religions and Conservations, makes us well placed to lead the initiative. And they've got investment priorities for dozens of traditions from 8 of the world's major faiths, Buddhism, Christianity, Taoism, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, Sikhism, Shintoism, and help to fuel an unprecedented interest. Then there's a growth in fossil fuel divestment, and studies have shown increased interest in ESG investing. So this is all corporate financial speak with a sort of source of faith over the top of it to make it look palatable to people.
Yeah, but now it gets really interesting, because when you look a little bit deeper into Faith Invest, you can see that there are international non-profit organization, right? But the interesting bit comes there, the accounting for sustainability. And this is where the linkage starts to join up even stronger again, because we're not going to have time in this snow smoke to talk about accounting. But the accounting for sustainability that was established by King Charles is extremely important. So bear that in mind, because on the next No Smoke, we'll come to talk about more about the King's involvement with accountants and auditing the world pretty much. So stay tuned for the second one. We've got a lot more to go through. So let's just go back to a slide on Faith Invest's progress, because I found this quite staggering. This one gives you some figures, and I'll let you again put your hand into the lucky dip and see what you find.
Shall I choose another one out of that?
Yeah.
I have to go to the sums of money they're talking about, although I'll just add that in 2009, speaking at ARC's Windsor celebration, was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, who said that faith groups comprise the third largest category of investors. It's fascinating, isn't it? They're all helping mankind, but there's tons of money on the side, as you say. A study of the economic value of religion to US society estimated faith had annual revenues of $378 billion annually, and they say that's more than those of tech giants Apple and Microsoft combined. And then if we go over to the right-hand side of the page and we just have a look, it's mentioned that $28 billion figure for the United Methodist Church in the States. The church pension fund for the U.S. Episcopal Church is $18.4 billion. Church of England, they say $10 billion, and a pension fund of $3 billion. Methodist Church, $1 billion. In Europe, the Vatican Bank manages $5.2 billion. That, to me, seems very, very, very low, but maybe we can come on to that another time. In the United States, reports say that the Church of the Latter-day Saints has an investment fund of $100 billion. So these are vast sums of money that are circulating around.
Go back a little bit, Brian, because there's one that you missed.
2022, it says that the Islamic finance group to $4 trillion in 2021 and is expected to reach $5.9 trillion in 2026, according to a 2022 study. And that doesn't surprise me at all, bearing in mind the area of the world encompassed by Islam. So, but huge amounts of money. And what do they want to do? They want to draw all this together so that they can get their sticky hands on it.
Yeah, they absolutely do. And at the end of the day, who are the royal family? What is their role? And, you know, I went to the royal family website, and I know that we're probably running out of time a little bit, so we'll maybe just skip through these next few slides just to tie it all up, because the royal family, apparently, according to the royal family website, they now rededicate their lives to serving the people of the United Kingdom, the realms, and the Commonwealth. So that was the King's coronation message. But luckily for us, on the Royal Family website, they've got a section for pretty much everything. So I went to look and see his role in the Church of England. So you might like to read a little bit of this out, because this is who he's meant to be, the head of the Church of England.
Well, can I just have a little moan before I do that for you, Devin? That is, when we see that picture of them standing there in their robes, they're not serving the people of the United Kingdom. They are absolutely serving their own interests. And our dialogue is exposing what's going on here. These people are not getting up in the morning and saying, my goodness, what can we do to help people in Cornwall who are having a tough time? Or what are we going to do up in the Midlands? They are living in their palaces. They're improving their palaces with an extra £650,000, which you just brought to our attention over upgrades, environmental upgrades to Balmoral. And then they have the audacity to stand there, weighted down by their gold braid, telling us they're serving us. I mean, the hypocrisy is mind-boggling to me. You know, push back at me, Debbie, but I've got to the point where I look at these people and I think, my goodness. And there were people fawning over the fact that Charles was being crowned and anointed with the holy oil. I just watched that and I thought, this is something very dark I'm watching, and their hypocrisy echoes that. I'm a bit motivated on this subject, as you can see.
Well, I mean, you know, we're an hour in, and I have to say to anybody that's watching, our viewers and listeners, we, at the moment, we're only just scraping the tip of the iceberg. There's far more to come in this series of No Smoke. I mean, it gets deeper and deeper. But I mean, let's take ourselves back to the fact that the King is he's head of the Church of England. That's who he is professing to be. And that's what the Royal Family website says. So, I mean, you can see there, Brian, what it says there on the screen.
Well, I'll read a bit for you. It says, the sovereign holds the title Defender of the Faith and Supreme Governor of the Church of England. These titles date back to the reign of King Henry VIII, who was initially granted the title Defender of the Faith in 1521 by Pope Leo X. When Henry VIII renounced the spiritual authority of the papacy in 1534, he was proclaimed supreme head on earth of the Church of England. This was repealed by Queen Mary I, but reinstated during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I, who was proclaimed supreme governor of the Church of England. Well, some interesting history there, which is a whole other level. But of course, what has Charles not protected? The faith. He's absolutely not protected that. So each stage we go into this, we just get more and more hypocrisy.
Interesting there was the wordage as well, supreme head of earth, on earth, which was interesting. But I mean, you know, being head of the Church of England obviously doesn't reap the king in enough money, because if you go to the Church of England website, they do put up there, they've got 10.3 billion, 1.2 billion, around 20. You can see the figures there, but obviously that's not enough for the king. So that's what he's meant to be head of. And yet, if we stay on the Royal Family website, we can see that they've got, very helpfully, lots of information about the king and other faiths. So you can see there on the screen, you know, this is what is said. I've always thought of Britain as a community of communities. That has led me to understand that the sovereign has an additional duty, less formally recognised, but to be no less diligently discharged. It is the duty to protect the diversity of our country, including by protecting the space for faith itself and its practice through the religions, cultures, traditions, and beliefs to which our hearts and minds direct us as individuals.
Yeah.
I mean, how much more obvious does it have to be?
Yeah, so I'm just going to stress this point, because we still have a pretty big audience of people who consider themselves Christians. But we've only got to look at what they are saying or what's coming out of their mouths or what's printed. And it's quite clear that the Christian religion is not top of the agenda for the royal family. There's something completely different happening. And when we start to look at the massive concern for, I'm deliberately going to use the term Mother Earth, this is not about love for mankind. We're witnessing something different here. But there are many Christian people out there very squeamish about getting into some of these areas. And I think that they've really got to toughen up and start to ask what we're dealing with here.
I agree. Look, my mum is 86. She's a holy duster at her church. She polishes the brass and things. She's struggling. And I get that. You know, she's gone to church all of her life. She has a very, she calls herself, she says she has a simple faith. She doesn't want to hear all of this. I was brought up, I went to church as a child. I went to Sunday school. I was a brownie. I was a guide. I was brought up in the Church of England. It's hard for me to swallow as well. And I get that it can be, it's not palatable for many people. But I think when you're putting your collection in the bowl when you go to church, where is that money going to? And why are we doing so much fundraising to keep our churches open when actually now many communities have only got one priest for six or seven churches? They no longer have a priest per church, if you like. They have a whole diocese. So what are the people that are going to these churches getting? What are they paying for is my question. And it is hard. And I agree, it is hard. But when you go on to look at what Charles is doing, you know, and you can see there's another entry on the Royal Family website. The King marks Interfaith Week with faith leaders at Lambeth Palace Library. So there's so many different lead-ins. And of course, you mentioned right at the beginning, Brian, the Royal Family's association with circumcision. And I've just put a slide up with an article there that just completely backs up all that you've said and gives a little bit of history there. So that's on the Jewish faith. But if you go back to the Royal Family website, you can see, well, I'll let you take us to the next slide, Brian.
So this was a speech by His Royal Highness, Prince of Wales, titled Islam and the West at the Oxford Centre for Islamic Studies. I believe wholeheartedly that the links between these two worlds matter more today than ever before, because the degree of misunderstanding between the Islamic and Western worlds remains dangerously high, and because the need for the two to live and work together in our increasingly independent world has never been greater. I find this a very important statement, because in talking about Christianity, that should not mean to anybody being hostile to people from other faiths. The point I'm certainly making, so let me nail some colours to the mast. The point I'm making is you cannot have a king who says he is there basically to preserve the faith of the country, which is Christianity, by our constitutional setup and by our belief structure, and then play a completely different game hidden in plain sight. It's the hypocrisy which gets me. And then the other thing is, look at what the king's position is at the moment, which has been, he has absolutely supported the slaughter in the Middle East. What happened with the attacks on Israel were bad. People died. There's no question of it. Children died, families died. But we're now in today, whatever it is, of the response from Israel. And we're up to 11,500 children killed, murdered, because they couldn't run. There was nowhere for them to go. But is Charles supporting Islam in that? Is he looking after the people in Gaza? No, he's simply looking after Israel. So again, what we come to is just unbelievable hypocrisy by this man. And that is so dangerous, because it means that he's double dealing. You don't know what is really in his mind and where he's really trying to go for. And people really need to wake up for this, because, as you say, we've only scratched the surface about what this man has been up to, using his immense status and huge reserves of money to create, which is all about a global agenda. It's nothing about his is round the world.
For me, Charles is the great pretender. He's been an heir in waiting for a very long time because he's been groomed for a very long time. The Queen has been taking, or the Queen Elizabeth was taking the attention while Charles was being groomed for so many years and building this empire. Just to give people a flavour of what religion seems to have become, because we're into the eco movement now.
So here we can see what is being done, in my opinion, what is being done to attack religion. So we've got eco-Islam, IFWS. I don't know what that stands for, but we're talking about eco-Islam, protecting our planet for future generations. If you're a member of the Islamic faith and you're listening into this podcast, what are we warning about? An attack on Islam, attack on Christianity. The faiths are being attacked in order to bring in this false global agenda of sustainability and control. We've got the next one, which is eco-Jesuit. So not even the Jesuits are immune to this one. And this is your Laudato Si action platform, the Eco-Jesuit Network. That doesn't fill me with great confidence. And I think we've got another one here, 450 Eco Amritsar, Eco-Sikh, planting 250 trees, I think, in the sacred city. And Eco-Sikh has been serving Mother Earth, it says. So this is absolutely nothing to do with core religions. It can't be anything to do with Christianity. So something else is coming. And we've got Eco-Dharma Network, the network of Buddhist organizations. But again, the focus is on the ecosystem of the environment. Green Christian, ordinary Christians, extraordinary times. Green Christian exists to share green insights with Christians and offer Christians insights to the wider green movement. We walk alongside those of faith and no faith. Join us. No, this is no faith, Debbie. Let's end on this point. This is nothing to do with faith. This is to do with a perversion of proper spiritual belief system, religious beliefs. And we're being led into something much darker. At that point, shall we just bring in the little video of the gold sovereign and then we'll close. Let's have a look at this little clip.
It's now been 500 days since the accession of our new monarch, King Charles III. And to mark this milestone, a new gold 1/8 sovereign coin's been minted. For the first time ever, this sovereign coin depicts the monarch alongside the dragon in place of St. George, with an historic legend that links to the coinage of both Queen Victoria and Queen Elizabeth II. By calling now on 0800 655 6215.
Well, there we are. We're not advertising gold coins. He said that King Charles III was alongside the dragon. I looked at that coin and I thought he's riding the dragon. So we've got the woman on the beast, the woman riding the... it's gone out of my head for the European...
The harlot.
Yeah, the harlot riding the bull, got there in the end, for the European Union. And here we've got the new king. He's replaced St. George. That shows some arrogance to start off with. Who decided that he was going to replace St. George and the dragon? So he's replaced St. George, but I don't think he's alongside the dragon. I think he's actually riding it. The commentator for that advert clip says towards the end, it rather seems as though he's tamed the dragon. Who do you think the dragon is?
Don't start me with that, because I can see so much symbology in it. And I saw that the first thing I saw was riding a dragon. This was a dragon with a forked tongue. And there were the initials. If people want to go back or go and look for an image of it, I don't know who created the coin. Maybe it was somebody just coincidentally with the initials JC, but JC's written at the breast of the dragon. I think you've noticed a couple of another anomalies on that picture.
I'll be careful because I didn't have my glasses on, but it looked to me that the orb, the globe that he's holding, that King Charles is holding in his hand, sitting atop it, is a Christian cross, but to my eyes, that cross looks slightly wonky, but I didn't have my glasses on. I'm going to admit my sin. So a lot of things can look a bit...
Say again. But the orb, just the significance of the orb being the earth. And I have to say, I know we're finishing up now, but this is just that we're going to go much further. It gets even more interesting the further on we go. So we really have only just scratched the tip of the iceberg to give people a bit of a flavour of where we're going. But there's so much more for people to see and to go and research themselves, because we always say, don't we, Brian, on anything, you know, we're just giving out signposts for people to do their own research, to come to their own opinions, to form their own beliefs. So we're not saying that, you know, you have to think this or do this. We're just throwing out some signposts for everyone to go and look a little bit further.
Yeah, great. And I'll just add to that, that if you're watching us from UK, you need to pay attention, because this man is living amongst us. But if you're overseas and you're another religion, you need to pay attention, because he's got his eye, I think, on the whole of the lands of the world. This man is not playing about being king of England. He's talking about being king of the earth. And we need to really be aware, very perceptive of what's coming down the pipeline here. We've got to end there. We'll say thank you very much for joining our first 2024 edition of No Smoke Without Fire. If you like it, please send us a comment, send us an email, and tell us whether you found this interesting and you like the format. And you might also tell us whether you like the new introduction of the match bursting into flame, but we thought it was brilliant. So well done, Mike Robinson. Debbie, thanks very much for joining me. We'll be back soon for episode 2 of No Smoke Without Fire. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.